Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you for coming. We are very excited to start the day. We are trying to start on time because we have a very busy program. So this is Philippe and I inaugural conference of the CEPR RPN on growth, innovation and social model in Europe. So just one word about this RPN. You know, we think that growth and innovation and productivity are really what Europe should be focusing on, so both in the policy side but also on the research side. That being said, we also want to promote a growth that is inclusive. We want to make sure that our social model is sustainable, and so for that reason we think it's very important to have both the labor economist crowd and the growth, innovation, productivity crowd that talks to one another. And so the goal of this group is to have a conference where we have both labor economists presenting, growth specialists presenting, etc. So we are very happy about the program today. We will have two keynotes. John will start right away with a 1 hour presentation, clarification questions only during the talk, please, and more substantial questions at the end. Other presentation will be half hour, and then at the end of the day, we will have Ufuk giving a 1 hour keynote as well. And this is the inaugural conference, but we will have one every year. So that's the plan. Usually, you know, in June, hopefully with some better weather. Today it is what it is, and so it's good to be inside and listening to these very interesting speakers. Thank you.
I don't need it. Thanks. No, it's always great to. So I'm very happy that John, you are starting with the keynote, and we are happy to have Beatrice with the president of CEPR with us, and also great to have you all with us at Collège, and I hope that we'll meet every year. Voilà, that's the floor is yours, John. You start.
Fantastic. So great. Well, thank you to the organisers for inviting me here and to the CEPR. It's fantastic to be back in the Collège again. To share some thoughts on you on the subject of the new network on innovation, growth, and the future of Europe. Okay, it's not a good start. I can use this. Fine. So caveat emptor, buyer beware. So almost the last 2 years, I've been in the UK government as the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers and senior advisor to the Chancellor Rachel Reeves. I've also worked with Mario Draghi in his report, but I'm no longer in government, so I'm speaking here in a purely private capacity. So don't blame anybody else apart from me. So when I was thinking of what to put together for this talk, I could have gone in a more technical direction. I've got some more recent work on the econometrics of production functions called NPR, which shows you how to estimate production functions in the cross-section controlling for quasi-fixed effects. But I think because this is a more general policy-oriented meeting, as well as people who are interested in research, I thought I would step back and talk a bit about the challenges that we face in Europe in terms of growth. So I'm going to focus on that. So I'll begin with some European challenges. I'm going to talk about some of the main challenges I see them. Climate change, security on defence, inequality, some things on AI and management, and then I'll try and wrap it up by talking about some political economy issues when we think about innovation policy, drawing a bit on my experience now of being in government as someone close to the heart of policymaking. Okay, so let's start off thinking about the kind of challenges we face as Europeans. And as a British person, I count myself as a European. So what is the challenge? So since at least the global financial crisis, growth has slowed across the OECD, so including in the US. So people often think, you know, Europe's in trouble and the US isn't. In fact, in reality, productivity growth, if you compare the decade before the global financial crisis to what's happened since, you know, US productivity growth has halved over this period. So it's not like, you know, the US has escaped the general growth slowdown. So if you look at GDP per hour worked, standard measure of labour productivity, in the years leading up to the financial crisis, the US productivity growth was about 2.2%, and it fell to about 1.1% since 2010. If you compare that to the Eurozone, then there's also been a halving of productivity growth in the Eurozone. But of course, the difference is that, you know, the Eurozone went in to the global financial crisis growing at a much slower rate than the US did, about 1.3 compared to 2.2. So that has meant that the gap between Europe and the US has risen. So I'm now going to steal from my co-author, Antonin Bergeau, some of his excellent numbers. So the way that he has presented this graph is to take the US as 100 as the baseline, and then to look at the Eurozone in comparison with Europe. So the gap is the kind of productivity gap between the two continents. So the light doesn't work here either. Okay, so we have to use the fingers, the old-fashioned method of the fingers. So, you know, since the Second World War, more or less, since 1950, the blue line shows you where Eurozone productivity was. So you can see that, you know, in 1950, there was this huge gap of about 60% in terms of productivity levels between Europe and the US. And then over the course of the post-war reconstruction period, Europe kind of caught up with the US until by the mid-1990s, Europe had basically caught up with the US. But then, since the mid-1990s, there's been, things went into reverse. So the gap has kind of gone from more or less parity to now a gap of almost 20% in terms of productivity since the mid-1990s, and that's particularly strong since the global financial crisis. So the reason for this is that in the mid-1990s, the information technology boom really took off. So the kind of quality-adjusted prices of ICT fell from something like, they were falling at 15 percentage points a year to about 30 percentage points a year. So this is the years of the growth of the internet, the IT revolution really took off. And then, you know, that happened much more strongly in the US than it did in Europe, and that's one of the forces. And then that got twisted again by the global financial crisis. So GDP per capita has also followed a similar pattern. It hasn't been quite as bad in some parts because of, you know, labour market reforms have kept employment rates up. But in terms of productivity, which is the kind of key thing in terms of wage growth and people's income growth, that has had a pretty poor performance. And in one graph, this is the kind of challenge we face, how to improve productivity growth, both in Europe, but also to some extent in the US. Now, there was a big debate over this happening as we speak between several people in this room and Paul Krugman over these graphs. I'm going to outsource that debate if we can get to Q&A on the differences. But suffice to say, I'm more on the side of my co-authors than I am on with Paul on this. Because I think the reality is that there is this gap which has opened up, and there is certain problems in Europe as well as in the US as well in terms of productivity growth. But certainly we do face a challenge in Europe to try and restore faster productivity growth. So why does this matter so much politically? I kind of call this, you know, we're now living in what you could describe as the populist doom loop. So low growth, as I've described there, leads on to anger with the system. So, you know, low productivity growth is a driving force of low wage growth, low income growth. People are, you know, unhappy, really, you know, they have a right to be unhappy because they, you know, they see the wages stagnating, they don't feel they're going to be better off than the parents were. So that creates a lot of anger with the system. And that anger with the system gets translated into increased support for populist parties, offering simple solutions to these problems, you know, ban the immigrants and other kinds of things. So these populist parties become more powerful, and that just leads to bad policies, bad economic policies, which again then leads to low growth, and then feeds back to this kind of doom loop. So case study one of this, I would say, would be Brexit. So the UK's position was actually worse than the Eurozone's. So after the global financial crisis, Britain's productivity growth has slowed to close to zero, except for the last couple of years, things have picked up, but there's been generally, you know, even worse productivity growth in the UK than there has in, in the Eurozone after the financial crisis. This, you know, slowdown in wage growth. Median wages were kind of pretty much flat in real terms. This led to anger with the system, the growth of support for a Brexit referendum from our friend Mr. Farage, supported by Mr. Trump. The government then called a vote, lost the vote thanks to Boris Johnson and others, and that led to a big further deterioration of growth. You know, my estimates pre-Brexit referendum predicted something like a 6% slowdown in growth. I think the ex-post evaluations have put it 6 to 8%. The official forecaster puts it at least 4%. So, you know, that has led to increased anger and I think part of the increased problems that we face. So, to me, this is probably the number one problem we actually face around the world today, because this is leading to a very difficult situation in terms of trying to get out of this doom loop. So, how do we get out of that? We have to realize that the old assumptions that we had about the global order have fundamentally shifted. The US security, you know, on top of these economic problems, the US security umbrella has weakened, so it means we have to increase our defense spending. The international trading system has been undermined by things like Liberation Day and the increased tariffs which the US has put on. We also have the problem of faltering climate change agreements, so we need to think of other things like green industrial policy, which I'll talk about. Ultimately, I think escaping from this doom loop, we have to get back to sustainable productivity growth, and we have to think about increasing productivity growth in a number of directions. So, you know, for advanced economies like Europe, we have to think about innovation at the frontier. We also have to think about faster diffusion of technologies like AI and other technologies around Europe. And we have to improve reallocation. We have to kind of shift resources from older, less productive parts of the economy to newer, more innovative, more productive parts of the economy. And that requires, you know, a need for radicalism in terms of thinking about structural reform and also greater investment. There are barriers to this agenda, political economy barriers. Now, you know, often these are exaggerated, and I'm going to argue that, and Philippe has argued as well, that many of these policies could be complementary. So there are policies which can be positive both for inequality, you know, both reducing inequality and also growth. Industrial policy can be a complement rather than a substitute to competition policy. So I think there are, you know, that's the opportunity. These are not always hard trade-offs, but there are some tough choices which are going to be inevitable when we think about how to restructure welfare, how we restructure the tax system. I think it's inevitable that taxes will have to rise, for example, if we want to pay for defence spending. So I think these are kind of tough choices which we can't duck away from. Okay, so let's get on to some of thinking about the challenges and what kind of research can say about them. So let me start off with climate change cleaning up innovation. So, you know, as we know, climate change is an enormous challenge for humanity, but it's also an enormous opportunity for growth and innovation. How do we reduce demand for fossil fuels? So, you know, one way is via carbon prices of one sort or another, higher carbon prices and regulation. These are both desirable. But we know that politically, to get to the level of carbon taxes we might need is very, very, very difficult. The public getting weary and pushing back on some of the green policies. As I mentioned, some of the global deals like the Paris Agreement are starting to fragment. So, you know, fundamentally, we're going to need technological change to deal with climate change. So what policies can help? So I'm going to have two excellent presentations today, exactly on green innovation. Antonin and Martin Derrida are going to be talking a bit about those. I first started working this with a paper with Philippe and other co-authors, where we kind of looked at carbon prices, looked at fuel taxes, and showed that in the auto industry, this could actually stimulate innovation. It didn't just change demand, it also meant that as auto manufacturers could see that the demand for fossil fuels, for kind of gas fuel, for gasoline was going to go up, they started switching to innovation in electric vehicles. We've kind of seen that, we showed evidence for that. In terms of thinking about more broadly though, I think we should also be thinking about industrial policy. You know, this has come to the fore in the Draghi report and also under the Biden administration. And the way I'm going to try and look at that is by focusing on a particular case study, which is in China, looking at the solar industry. And this is going to draw on some work that I've been doing recently with Robin Burgess, my colleague at LSE, and also a fantastic team of PhD students, Ignacio, Paul, David, and Yifan. So we call this Ray of Hope because it's about solar power, so rays from the sun. But we also think it's a ray of hope because it gives you an idea of a kind of industrial policy, a green industrial policy, which can help to tackle climate change. So here's the, you know, if you get depressed about climate change, here's a bit of optimism. So if you look at the price of solar power, so this is how much it costs to get a watt of energy out of a solar cell. So that cost about $100 per watt in the mid-70s. This is a log scale, so you can see there's an enormous fall of price. The price fell to about $5 by 2005. And today it's around about 20, 25 cents. So now solar power is actually competitive with coal and other kinds of fossil fuels to generate energy, which is an amazing accomplishment. So this is a hope as solar modules become cheaper, we can kind of use this as an alternative to fossil fuel. This big fall of price has coincided with the rise of China in this industry. So China's market share, this is in red, of the global industry was close to zero in 2003-04, and then rose to about 80% or so by 2021. So a massive increase of the importance of China. Now, China's risen in many different industries, in toys and games and clothing. Is it just kind of imitating the technologies of the West? Yeah, there's definitely some of that going on. But I think China is doing more than just imitating, as it has in other industries. It's also innovating as well. So if you look at a measure, say, of patents, this is solar patents in China, it's gone again from near zero to an enormous amount, so over almost 30,000 patents a year. And this is, you might say, well, are these just low quality patents? If you look at citation weighted patents as a measure of quality, or tradic patents, these are patents taken out in the US, Europe, and also in Japan, those have also kind of increased tremendously as well. And so what one measure of this I kind of like is the frontier. So in solar power, you can actually measure how things are advancing at the frontier. There's these competitions held around the world every year for the most powerful and efficient forms of solar cells. So these competitions have been going on since the mid-1970s, and you can see back in 1980, the US basically won every competition. It was totally dominant. But then over time, other countries started getting involved, Australia and Germany. China was nowhere to be seen until about 2010, when it won its first competition. But today, in 2025, China wins about half of all these competitions. So they're innovating right at the frontier. So China has moved from being a kind of producing relatively low quality type of products now to really producing and innovating at the frontier. So what we try and do in this paper is we kind of evaluate the role of the Chinese solar industrial policy to the growth of the industry, to innovation, and to this fall of prices. And the way we do that is we put together panel data on the universe of solar firms in China, so that includes non-Chinese as well as Chinese firms. We exploit the fact that if you look at how did China develop, one of the ways that China has developed is not by centralized five-year plans, but also by allowing local regional and city governments to experiment with different types of policies. So the central plan kind of sets the general indication, but a lot of the activity is actually at the kind of city level. So the city level bureaucrats have a strong incentive to do this, because if they can grow their city regions faster, then that enables them to rise up in the Communist Party to get more senior jobs. So there's kind of career incentives for them to do this. So in the paper, what we do is we exploit the fact that different city regions introduce different solar subsidies at different times, and we can use the staggered rollout of these different policies to try and look at what the impact of these policies was on the output and innovation in the kind of solar industry in China. And we focus on three types of subsidies. So one is on demand policy, so that's subsidies for using renewables and power stations, or putting solar power on your rooftop. So feed-in tariffs would be an example of that. The second group of subsidies are around production subsidies. So if you produce more solar panels in your area, you're going to get some subsidies for this. And the last one is kind of research and development or innovation subsidies. So we distinguish between these three different types of subsidies. We do different econometric techniques. We use a method of, you know, basically called synthetic difference of differences, where for each city which introduces the policy, we look at a kind of a matched set of synthetic control cities who didn't introduce the policies, and then compare those over time to look at the impact of the policies. So we do this to get, and I'll show you, we find quite strong local effects at the city level on the growth of the solar industry. But of course, you know, those are only local effects. It might well be that, you know, say Beijing grows its solar industry, but it's stealing all the business from Shanghai. So from a macroeconomic point of view, there's not an increase, it's just moving activity around. So in order to look at the macro implications, we develop and estimate a structural equilibrium model of the industry. So, you know, the theoretical structure is we have these 358 city regions. They have different productivities and comparative advantage of producing solar power and different demands because of population. We think of a kind of a grid planner who can build a mix of clean and dirty power plants. So clean, think of solar, dirty, think of coal. We have heterogeneous input suppliers. So think of solar panel makers. They're producing solar panels. They're making decisions over entry and exit, production, exporting, and innovation. So we think of innovation as you pay a fixed cost in order to reduce your marginal costs of producing, say, solar panels. And then we take into account all these multiple spillovers against cross cities. So these are business stealing effects, like, you know, as I mentioned, you know, maybe Beijing is just stealing business from Shanghai. But there could also be positive spillovers. So if you create more demand for solar power in Beijing, maybe some of those solar panels actually get supplied by Shanghai or from Xiaoping or some other part of China. And there could be another positive spillover with learning. So as I showed you, there is a lot of learning by doing and innovation going on in the industry. And if firms can imitate other firms, then some of the benefits of the innovation in one city and what can spill over to other cities as well. So, you know, those spillover effects can be positive as well as negative. So we can put all these together using our empirical estimates to discipline the structural model to then simulate what the effect was of industrial policy in China, as well as considering alternative policies, counterfactual policies. So I won't go into this in detail, but these are just examples of the type of production subsidies that we have. You know, the cost of new solar production in Hi-Fi will be subsidized by 12%. So the way we get this information is we use this thing called the PKU law database, which is a database with all the regulations and laws of different policies in China. And we extract from that all the policies related to solar power. And then we use that in order to track the introduction of these policies across different areas. So just to show you what that looks like, there weren't any policies until 2006. But by the end of our sample period in 2021, there were 43 cities which had introduced some kind of subsidy for solar power. First of all, they started off with production subsidies and some innovation subsidies, and then demand subsidies became a lot more popular around 2013. So there's a mixture of these different policies across different cities in China. And that's the variation we're going to be exploiting. So if you look in 2004, the dark areas are indicating how many patents there were in each of these different city regions in China. It was 358 across the whole of China. And you can see there's not very many. But if you play the movie forward till 2019, you can see that there's patenting going on almost across the whole of China. The dark areas that I put in there signify the fact that these are city regions which have had some type of policies. So you can see that the policies are quite spread out. There's a bit of a greater strength in the eastern seaboard, but you can see there's a wide range of activity, of production, and also in this case of innovation happening. So what do we find? So at the local level, the level of the city, we find that production innovation subsidies substantially raised innovation as measured by patents or site weighted patents or productivity, output, exports, and also net entry. We find that demand subsidies, by contrast, although the effects are positive, they're what much smaller and much less precisely determined. These demand policies did have effects on pollution, however. So if you look at PM2.5, that's a measure of particulate matter in the air, you know, which gives people lung problems. The demand policies which supported renewables reduced that type of pollution quite a lot. So you're going to see that in a picture. This is the kind of the event study. So this looks at the introduction of any subsidy, and the dots show you that the, you know, there appears to be a kind of causal impact of the introduction of the policy on innovation activity. This doesn't happen immediately, it kind of builds up over time, but you can see that there is this clear kind of break when the policy was kind of introduced into a particular city. And this is, you know, if you, these just give you the average treatment effects. So, you know, this shows you that there's an effect of any subsidy in the first column. The demand subsidies, as I mentioned, are positive but weak, and they get stronger and stronger if you look at production subsidies or innovation subsidies. The reason we think that the demand subsidies are the weakest is goes back to this idea that if you encourage the use of renewables in your power plants, that's great for you know, in renewables, but those solar panels could be produced anywhere in China. They don't necessarily need to be produced in say, Shanghai, if Shanghai introduces the policy. Now, there's transport costs, so that gives some local boost to the industry. But, you know, those transport costs are not overwhelming. You know, a lot of them are exported. So you actually get much weaker effects, on at least locally, from the impact. So that's the local level. But what happens if we look at the national level? So we find that the, you know, putting the model together and simulating the model, we find that policies are actually quite effective at the national level. They account for something like 40 to 50% of the change of Chinese solar output, prices, and innovation. So here's the innovation measure, for example. So the blue line is what kind of actually happened with the real subsidies, and the dotted orange line is our estimate of the counterfactual, which is what would have happened to innovation in the absence of the policies. So you can see that there was a significant impact of the policy rollout, accounting for something like half of all the increase of innovation. It's similar for prices and output. Now, it shows that not everything is because of the policy. You know, the growth of demand in the rest of the world for solar power, the growth of wealth in China, would have helped this industry anyway, like it did for many other industries. But there was, on top of that, an important effect of the policy that China had. So we can then look at the kind of social cost benefit of these policies. So of course, I showed you the benefits, got more innovation, but there's a cost. You had to do loads of subsidies. So we look at what the rate of return was to a dollar or, you know, rimbe or euro of subsidy. So we find that a dollar of subsidy increased the welfare for Chinese citizens by $1.65 at a 65% rate of return. And importantly, this is ignoring the social cost of carbon. It's ignoring the environmental benefits completely. This is just the benefits because prices fell a lot, and that's good for Chinese people, and they managed to export a lot, which is, you know, beneficial for Chinese firms as well. So those pure economic benefits meant that the policy paid for itself. And you know, I'll get back to what that means in terms of industrial policy in general, but that's a very optimistic story. If you added in the benefits of the social cost of carbon, we take a value of $36 per tonne here from the Carlton et al. QJ estimates, you more or less double the benefit cost ratio. So, you know, if you, you know, different people put different weights on those environmental benefits, but those mean that the policy seems to be very, very attractive. And then finally, we say, well, okay, we could have done even better, or the Chinese could have done even better. Say, instead of the actual policies they pursued, they changed the policy mix. So we say, well, let's imagine you use the same amount of money, but put it towards innovation, innovation-heavy type of policy mix. We find that the kind of benefits are actually even larger, something like three, four, five times as big. And the reason that they're so much larger is that the main market failure in this industry is are these knowledge spillovers. We estimate very large knowledge spillovers of learning by doing spillovers, which are not fully captured by the firms who are innovating, which is spilling over to other firms. And that market failure, that classic market failure, is the main reason why you get inefficiency in the model. So the subsidies actually relieve that market failure and therefore can create lots of benefits. If you made it even more innovation heavy, you'd get even more benefits at the same cost. So why does this matter? Well, as I mentioned, you know, we're struggling with international agreements. If green industrial policy here is it may be a politically feasible solution because it gives benefits to, if well crafted, to the country, even abstracting away from some of the environmental benefits. So it does suggest, in my view, a potential role for industrial policy in some areas. I wouldn't want to take this example, you know, solar energy in China, and say that's true for every industry in China or in the world. But it does suggest the type of industries that we might want to focus on in Europe if we wanted to have a well-crafted industrial policy. You have to think of industries which are high-tech, which have high potential growth, which have high externalities, in areas or countries where the region has some actual latent comparative advantage. So those are the kind of criteria that we should be thinking of when we think about trying to craft an industrial policy. Now, an obvious question here is that I've shown you the impact inside of China. What about the impacts outside of China? So, you know, obviously, you know, we worry about the European solar industry may have been decimated by Chinese imports, and you know, are these benefits going to China but at the expense of Europe and other parts of the world? In order to assess that, and this is the kind of what we're currently working on, global solar project, you know, there are these negative effects in business dealing, but they could be offset by the benefits of lower prices. You know, now as I showed you, you know, we can get much cheaper solar power, and there may be benefits from these learning or knowledge externalities, especially now China's innovating at the frontier. So within China we see this. So if we look at within China, when we look at the spillover effects, we found the spillover effects were net positive. So the business dealing effects were offset, more than offset, by these knowledge externalities and the increase of demand. Now, that may not be true at the global side, so that's kind of what we're currently looking at. But I think when we, you know, in terms of thinking about this, we have to take all these different spillover effects into account to get a global assessment of the impact. Okay. So let me move on to security and defence after climate change. So obviously, you know, we're living in this era of global geopolitical instability. Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its threat to Europe, increased conflict in the Middle East, America distancing itself from NATO and European defence. If you look at the share of military expenditure of the top 15 countries in the world, the US is 37%, China is 12%. Russia is 5.5%, and you know, Germany is only 3%, the UK is only 3%. So the military spending is very much dominated at the moment by the United States. So if the United States is moving away from NATO, that's as we know, that's a very serious problem. So how we have to increase defence spending. So the question is how can we make defence spending more pro-growth? We don't want to, you know, is it just going to be a huge drain in our resources, or can we do things to actually help foster growth? So I'm going to focus on two elements of this. So one is, you know, in my view, an important way, if we're going to raise defence spending, is to have a large element of that, or significant element of that, on research and development. And secondly, for any given research and development budget, we need to make this the most effective for innovation. So, you know, I'm going to argue making it more open and decentralized is a way of doing that. I'm going to draw on two papers that I published with co-authors last year, which tries to make the case for these things. So, historically, military necessity has been the mother of invention. So, one example of this is a photograph of the Battle of Syracuse in 1213 BC. This was a military innovation called the Claw of Archimedes. Archimedes, he of the laws, was in Syracuse helping defend it from the Roman invasion, and came up with this so-called Claw of Archimedes, which was sinking the Roman battalions here. There may be some artistic license, I'm not sure. But it shows you the idea, you know, of how you know military innovation can, you know, innovation is often used in the service of the military. And if you look at, throughout history, even in more recent years, lots of frontier defence technologies have large spillovers to the private sector. So think about GPS, cryptography, nuclear power, jet engines, and the internet. These are all things which originally developed in the military military needs in mind, but have become things which have been widely used in civil society. So there's lots of stories about this, but can we go further from storytelling to hard evidence? So in this paper with Enrico Moretti and Claudia Steinwender, we try to do this using data across the whole of the OECD, covering 26 countries at the industry level over 23 years. And we also use some fantastic French level panel data from 12,500 firms since 1980. We focused on the impact of defence R&D, both directly and also as a kind of instrumental variable for government policy, because defence R&D is, you know, driven by military and geopolitical concerns rather than economic concerns in general. And what we found in the paper was very strong evidence for how public R&D, especially public defence R&D, crowded in rather than crowded out private R&D. And furthermore, we found that the defence R&D had a positive impact both on domestic and international productivity growth. So that led to quite a positive assessment. And there's been some recent macro studies. We use kind of micro and industry data, but using macro data, there's some very nice studies that confirm these positive effects of defence R&D. There is a bit of a secondary question, which is the focus of these more macro papers, which, you know, if you were going to have an extra euro of R&D spending, should you allocate it to defence or non-defence? There's some evidence that, you know, the non-defence R&D in the long run can be more effective in terms of productivity than defence R&D. But I think that's the wrong question, because we have to raise military R&D. The question is, how can you raise military spending in a way which is the most pro-growth? So it's not, you know, the question is not, we've got an increase of the R&D budget, how do you allocate it? The question is, how can we make the increase of defence spending, which we're going to have to do, more pro-growth? And I think the argument we should be making is we want to make that as R&D intensive as possible. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, well, how, you know, given an R&D budget, how do you get more innovation out of that R&D budget? So in recent work with Sabrina Howell, Jason Rathje, who is a commander in the US Air Force, and Jun Wong, we've tried to address this by looking at a really interesting US reform to R&D procurement in the military. So the traditional approach to defence R&D procurement in the US and most countries is it's very top-down and highly centralised. So DARPA, which everybody points to as a great example, is actually quite exceptional in the defence ecosystem. Most of the procurement is tightly specified. So, you know, an example would be, you know, we're looking for an R&D project to deliver a kind of silver paint which can go on a drone which will reflect radars, and tell us how to kind of, you know, do the R&D to do that. So that's pretty tightly specified. So if you look at the US defence innovation base over the last four decades, it's actually weakened. So, you know, if you look at the degree of innovation relative to other parts of the economy, defence innovation has become less effective in terms of producing innovations, if you measure this by, you know, citation, weighted patent counts or other measures. And this has gone alongside high and increasing concentration in the industry. So these two trends, increasing concentration and reducing research productivity, mimics what's happening in the rest of the US economy. So, you know, there's the rise of these mega firms or superstar firms in general, and there's evidence of R&D productivity falling. But these trends, which, you know, we've shown are true in the general economy, are actually very strong, much stronger in defence sector. So, you know, these problems led the US Air Force in 2018 to reform elements of its R&D procurement program through its kind of so-called SBIR program, Small Business Innovation Research Program. And what they did was, they've run these competitions. What they did was they introduced what they called a new open topics program, which ran alongside the older conventional program that was much more centralized and highly specified. So the open kind of model is a decentralized innovation model. And the competitions basically said, instead of the US Department of Defense specifying what they thought they need, they said to the firms and the universities, tell us what you think we need for improving the US Air Force's innovation system. And, you know, that was the competition that they ran, and they've run this ever since 2018. So what we did was we put together administrative data on all the applications to these competitions, so about 21,000 applications. And we also got the evaluation scores of all of these proposals from three different you know, referees, you could think of them, that they had in the military. So we did this from 2003 to 2019 and looked at outcomes through to 2021. We focused on the 2017 to 2019 proposals because at that point you had open and conventional competitions running side by side. So what we found was that these open programs attracted a lot more new entrants, young firms from Silicon Valley who had never applied for the program before, now started to put a lot more applications in and start winning more competitions. We also did a kind of regression discontinuity design because we had the scores of the applications as well as who succeeded. And we found that adoption of the new technology, so it wasn't just the research and development contracts, we could actually look at whether they were actually used in the military. They increased significantly, patenting increased significantly, funding from venture capitalists, so you know, private sector funding also increased. Whereas for this is the open competition, the conventional competition basically didn't seem to do very much at all. It increased the chance, if you won it, you increased your chance of winning another competition in the future, so it actually increased lock-in and persistent dominance, but it didn't seem to have much of an effect on innovation. So just to give you an example, on the left-hand side is the open competition. So this is looking at future technological adoptions as measured by Department of Defense contracts as an outcome. You can see that the kind of the guys who just won, they're the ones, there's about a 10% increase of likelihood of future technological adoption, whereas the guys who just lost, minus one before, there's basically no effect. That's the open competition, the conventional competition, there's no effect happening there. So that's consistent with a very strong causal impact of the open competition. So why was it so successful? We argue that mainly this was because it was a kind of a bottom-up innovation model. But and we could show this by looking at, if you looked amongst the more conventional competitions over the last 20 years, some of those were tightly specified, some of them were a bit less tightly specified. So we could use AI, use machine learning techniques, looking at the types of the applications and show that the more diffuse, less specified conventional ones over the last 20 years also looked like these open competitions. So that suggests that, you know, there was a real effect of crowding in better ideas. And there was also some effect from selection. So, you know, there's a treatment effect, but there's also some effect on the selection of having these young firms coming in from Silicon Valley and other kind of high-tech hubs which wouldn't traditionally have been in part of the system. So the implication, you know, what happened subsequently is now this program got rolled out across the rest of the US Air Force and Department of Defense and other parts of government. The model is starting to be used in other countries. The UK has this DARSA program, which is built on a similar kind of idea. Interestingly, if you look at the war in Ukraine, it's been using something analogous to kind of crowdsource technology in the drone space, you know, trying to crowdsource ideas in. So I think this is becoming an increasingly popular model. So, you know, what does this mean in terms of Europe? I think that, you know, two things I said, defence spending has to rise, you know, we're going to have to raise taxes or cut other spending to pay for this. But the main thing is we want to focus on using the spending in the most pro-growth way. So increasing the fraction of spending dedicated to R&D, but using the R&D budget better, particularly maybe this more open and decentralized method that I've just described. Okay, so you know, I'm going to speed up a little bit just to deal with the last couple of things. So on inequality, you know, the thing to think about here is, you know, although, you know, we'd like to reduce inequality, it's hard to do redistribution in the context of slow growth. If you have faster growth of the economic pie, everybody can be better off even with the redistribution. If the pie is not growing, you're having to take more money away from one group to give to other people. So slow growth actually makes redistribution harder. You know, there's a debate here in France around, you know, wealth taxes and other ways. could we do this just by taxing the rich a lot more? I think the problem is there's probably just not enough rich people to go around. If you really want to get enough money for redistribution or other things, you have to actually go beyond just thinking you can tax the billionaires to do this. I remember my first job after graduating was at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and the head of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Andrew Dillard, always said, the great quote on taxation, which was the focus of work at the IFS, was, everybody thinks, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the man behind the tree. And of course, unfortunately, there's not enough men behind the tree to get enough tax from them to pay for the things you want. So, I think the reality is that, we can't just rely on taxing rich people, very rich people, more and more. We have to think about policies which both try to reduce inequality but also support growth at the same time. So to do that, in my view, we should be thinking about human capital-focused innovation policy. And that requires finding and nurturing talented people who typically might not become entrepreneurs or innovators. So kids from low-income families, women and minorities who we have relatively few of them who are innovators. I put a picture of Marie Curie up here. Sometimes we call this the kind of lost Marie Curie or lost Einstein effect. If you think about entrepreneurs, we could call this the kind of lost Stephanie Jobs type of effect. But if you can think of policies which reduce the barriers to those type of people becoming innovators, that actually is good for equality of opportunity, it's good for inequality, but it's also good for growth, because these are talented people we're missing out on. If we can reallocate their talent, we can create a lot more growth. If you think about such supply-side innovation policies, they're going to be much more effective in the long run. Demand-side policy, which I still support, like R&D tax credits, increases demand for R&D. But if you increase demand without increasing supply, all you do is drive up the price, which is great for scientists and researchers and entrepreneurs because we get higher wages, but not so good for the taxpayer if you want to increase the amount of overall innovation. So just to show you the kind of basic findings here. So on the x-axis, these are parents' household income. On the y-axis is the number of inventors who subsequently are the kids born into these households of different income levels. So the bottom line here is if you're lucky enough to be born in the top 1%, you're 10 times more likely to grow up to be an inventor than if you're born in the bottom 50%. So a very big difference of outcomes. If you look at entrepreneurship, you also see a big advantage to be born in a rich household. So the top 1% being born in the top 1% of rich households are about 2.5 times more likely to be an entrepreneur than if you were born at the 90th percentile. So, in both cases, entrepreneurship is if you found a firm, innovation is if you're on a patent. But in both cases, I think, was it Voltaire who said this, choose your parents wisely. So if you want to be an inventor or an entrepreneur. Early ability matters. So, some people say, well, this is because, if you're rich, your parents are very smart, so therefore genetically you're very smart. So early ability does matter, but it only accounts for a pretty small part of this parental income effect. And for entrepreneurs, it's even smaller. So what matters for inventors is many things, but one thing is childhood exposure, the kind of neighborhood you grew up in, the school you went to, the exposure to the idea that someone like you might be an inventor. For entrepreneurs, we find that labour market experience matters a lot more than childhood exposures or liquidity. So if you were fortunate enough to have experience of being in a kind of more entrepreneurial industry or more entrepreneurial firm when you start off in the labour market, that is strongly correlated with you actually starting up your own firm later on. So we try and investigate that by using industry shock. So think about a 22-year-old graduating in San Francisco in 1999, the dot-com boom was, I was actually on my first sabbatical in Berkeley then. Everything was going crazy, loads of companies. If you graduated from university, you could easily get a job there. I'm being signaled at something. What's the signal?
10 minutes.
Okay, 10 minutes. Okay, great. No, I'm on time. I'll try and avoid some of the anecdotes. So the idea is that if you graduated during the dot-com boom in 1999, 22-year-olds, big chance of working for a tech firm. That's a very high entrepreneurship sector. You are more likely to be an entrepreneur. If you graduate the next year in 2000 and dot-com bust, you're much less likely to work in into the tech sector, much less likely to be an entrepreneur through nothing to do with your own self, but just through bad, good or bad luck. So you can use that quasi-experimental variation to get a causal impact of the role of labour market experience on entrepreneurship. And we find that's very important, both in terms of overall levels of entrepreneurship and also these gaps that you see between different groups in the population. So the big question here is, what kind of policies can you do to tackle this? There's things you can think of in the education system, tracking in schools, also information exposure. So there's some evidence that even, you know, mild interventions, you know, people who are in this Breeder et al. Paper, female scientists going into schools and talking to some of the girls there about the opportunities of going to do STEM subjects seems to be quite effective. So information exposures, mentorship, internship programs, competitions, anti-discrimination policies. I think this is an area where we need to have a lot more work in terms of what kinds of policies could be effective. But I think the prize here is very large for improvements. Okay, so quickly on AI. So I think on AI, the story here is that, you know, looking at the history of technologies and waves of technology, that it takes many years, decades, between the invention of a new technology and its eventual impact on productivity. And the reason it takes so long is there needs to be lots of experimentation. You need to think about the organization and management of the firms who are able to best make use of that new technology. That's what we see, you know, there's a lot of work I've been involved with Nick Bloom and Raphael Sadun, looking at that mid-1990s IT revolution and showing that the firms which benefited most from that were the firms which had stronger management practices, more flexible organizations, and that actually accounts for some of the US-European gap. So, you know, I think that, you know, there's many case studies which suggest that organization is critical here, and that there's this, you know, strong complementarity between technology and different forms of management practice in impacting productivity. So we've seen some quite large AI effects in very detailed micro studies, but when we go up to the level of the firm, the industry, or the economy, these effects look much more muted. And I think that's consistent with this issue about, you know, it's not just about the cheapness or quality of the technology, it's also about how it gets used in actual organizations. Now, you know, we're in the early days of AI, maybe the effects will be much faster than previous general purpose technologies. But my guess is that if we want to think about policies about making the best use of AI and also making it more labor friendly, we need to think about ways of actually improving management practices. So structural policies like stronger competition, improving governance, taking away, you know, tax breaks from many inefficient firms like family-run firms, thinking about openness to foreign direct investment, thinking about regulation, direct policies, consultancy intervention, training interventions. In some work with Danny Esker and co-authors, we're actually going to go through some of these management policy toolkits, which are ways of improving the management which can be complementary to technology. So I won't go through all this, but you know, we have a lot of work with Nick and co-authors on looking at management scores across countries, huge variation within countries, strongly suggesting that competition is one important factor here. But the broad lesson, I think, is that when we think about policies towards AI, we should think not just about direct policies, but also policies how we can improve the organization and management of firms. Okay, so let me wrap up with the final section on the politics of innovation policy. So I've argued that Europe needs to grow, and the surest path to this is through innovation, which includes faster diffusion and reducing misallocation. We have developed toolkits for innovation policy. This is kind of work with Heidi Williams. We look at different policies, we look at the quality of the evidence, look at the effects of inequality, benefit cost ratios and the time frame. As I mentioned, we focus a lot on supply side policies, such as these kind of, you know, policies towards finding the lost Einsteins, but there's, you know, a wider range of different policies that we've looked at in this work. The fundamental problem, I think, of innovation policy is the dilemma of long policy lags. So even, you know, in this kind of table, I put R&D, you know, the number of light bulbs is how great the benefit cost ratio is. The R&D tax credits gets 3 light bulbs, which is really good policy in terms of the evidence and also the impact. But think about the R&D tax credit. First of all, you have to persuade the government, you know, to do it. Then the government needs to change the tax law and implement the changes. Businesses then need to recognise the change, increase their R&D. The R&D has to increase productivity. Productivity needs to be fed through to real wages. And then citizens need to recognise this income boost and credit the government with, you know, with the policy that they've done. Now, that's a, you know, even if all of those things are true, and of course the last one may particularly not be true, you know, citizens may not recognise that, you know, the income increase is due to the policy. But even if all of these steps occur, it takes many years, you know, much longer than a single electoral cycle. And, you know, some of the policies that we recommend, like in education interventions, take even longer to see impacts. For politicians, you know, their survival, you know, reflects the public desires for seeing results and disliking trade-offs. So it's a real dilemma to how you can persuade governments to do the kind of innovation policies we think will be good, but will not give them kind of political dividends for that, except in the very long run. Now, these problems are not confined to innovation policy. So think of, you know, things like deficit reduction and consolidation. They also have problems similar to this, you know, regulatory reform and so on. But this is the real dilemma that we kind of face. So I don't think there's any easy solution to this, but, you know, there is no alternative towards thinking of things which increase growth, and, you know, the foundation of growth has to be innovation. So we either act now with purpose, or, you know, we face an increasing crises which will force us to act in a haphazard way. And I think that one of the positive things, say, about this group we're in now, focusing around innovation and growth, is a very positive story. It's not just about, you know, fiscal consolidation, which is important to do. It's very much, you know, that's a very kind of negative thing we do less. The innovation story is a very positive thing, that we can do things that kind of grow the economy and make the world a better and exciting place. And I think the examples I'm trying to give on climate change, around green industrial policy, around defence, which is enhancing research and development, making it more open, on inequality, searching for the lost Einsteins, the lost Marie Curies, on AI, thinking about how we improve management, something we want to do anyway. These are much more positive stories than the more negative things about what we might need for dealing with the crises that we face. So I think, you know, to tackle this, we require better research and policy engagement, which I think is exactly the purpose of this new network, which I think is a thoroughly great thing. So thank you very much, and I'll stop there for a few questions.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.